Seoul's control, and China is now South Korea's biggest trading partner. Driving along the coast, all I saw at South Korean ports were Chinese ships. Other factors also work in Beijing's favor. China harbors thousands of North Korean defectors that it would send back after a collapse, in order to build a favorable political base for China's gradual economic takeover of the Tumen River region, the Northeast Asian River Valley where China, Russia, and North Korea intersect, with good port facilities on the Pacific. De facto control of a future Tumen prosperity sphere would bolster China's fiscal strength, helping it to do economic battle with the United States and Japan. If China's troops could carve out a buffer zone in the part of North Korea near Manchuria, where China is now developing massive infrastructure projects, such as roads and ports, Beijing might then sanction the installation of an international coalition elsewhere in the north. Russia's weakness in the Far East is demonstrated by its failure to prevent the creeping demographic conquest of its eastern territories by ethnic Chinese. It will be truculent in guarding its interests on the Korean Peninsula. And Russia does have a historical legacy here. North Korea was originally a Soviet creation and client state. Keeping Russian troops out of Korea would probably be more trouble for the other powers than letting some in. Of course, South Korea would bear the brunt of the economic and social disruption in returning the peninsula to normalcy. No official will say this out loud, but South Korea, along with every other country in the region, has little interest in reunification, unless it were to happen gradually over years or decades. The best outcome would be a South Korean protectorate in much of the north, officially under an international trusteeship, that would keep the two Koreas functionally separate for a significant period of time. This would allow each country time to prepare for a unified Korean state, without the attendant chaos. Following the communist regime's collapse, the early stabilization of the North could fall unofficially to the U.S. Pacific Command, PACOM, and U.S. Forces Korea, which is a semi-autonomous sub-command of PACOM, also wearing blue UN helmets. But while the U.S. military would have operational responsibility, it would not have sole control. It would have to lead an unwieldy regional coalition that would need to deploy rapidly in order to stabilize the North and deliver humanitarian assistance. A successful relief operation in North Korea in the weeks following the regime's collapse could mean the difference between anarchy and prosperity on the peninsula for years to come. If North Korea attacks. But what if, rather than simply unraveling, the North launched a surprise attack on the South? This is probably less likely to happen now than it was, say, two decades ago, when Kim Il-sung commanded a stronger state and the South Korean armed forces were less mature. But Colonel Maxwell and others are preparing for this possibility. Simply driving through Seoul, one of the world's great and congested megacities, makes it clear that a conventional infantry attack on South Korea's capital is something that not even a fool would contemplate. So, if the North were to attack, it would likely resort instead to a low-grade demonstration of shock and awe, using its 13,000 artillery pieces and multiple rocket launchers to fire more than 300,000 shells per hour on the South Korean capital, where close to half the nation's 49 million people live. The widespread havoc this would cause would be amplified by North Korean special operations forces, which would infiltrate the South to sabotage water plants and train and bus terminals. Meanwhile, the North Korean People's Army would march on the city of Wijongbu, north of Seoul, from which it could cross over the Han River and bypass Seoul from the east. But this strategy would fail. While American A-10 Warthogs, F-16 Vipers, and other aircraft would destroy enemy missile batteries and kill many North Korean troops inside South Korea, submarine-launched missiles and B-2 Spirit bombers sent from Guam and Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri would take out strategic assets inside North Korea. In the meantime, the South Korean army would quickly occupy the transport hubs while unleashing its own divisions and special operations forces on the marauding People's Army. The KFR knows this. Thus, any such invasion would have to be the act of a regime in the latter phases of disintegration. North Korea's lone hope would be that the hourly carnage it could produce, in the time between the first artillery barrage on Seoul and the beginning of a robust military response by South Korea and the United States, would lead the South Korean left, abetted by the United Nations and elements of the global media, to cry out for diplomacy and a negotiated settlement as an alternative to violence. And there is no question, the violence would be horrific. Iraq and Afghanistan would look clean by comparison. A South Korea filled with North Korean troops would be, in military parlance, a target-rich environment, in which the good guys and the bad guys would always be close to each other. Gnarly chaos is how one F-16 Viper pilot described it to me. The ultimate fog of war. The battlefield would be made more confusing by the serious language barrier that exists between American pilots and South Korean JTACs, or Joint Tactical Air Controllers, who would have to guide the Americans to many of their targets. A-10 and F-16 pilots in South Korea have complained to me that this weak link in the bilateral military relationship would drive up the instances of friendly fire and collateral civilian deaths, on which the media undoubtedly would then concentrate. As part of a deal to halt the bloodbath, members of the KFR might be able to negotiate their own post-regime survival. What now, Lieutenant? But middle and upper-middle levels of the American military worry less about an indiscriminate artillery attack on the South than about a very discriminate one. My sources feared that in the aftermath of the KFR's missile launches in July, the Bush administration might actually have been foolish enough to react militarily, which might have been exactly what Kim Jong-il was hoping for, since it would have allowed him to achieve a primary strategic goal, splitting the alliance between South Korea and the United States. How would that happen? After the United States responded in a targeted fashion to the missile launches or some other future outrage, the North would initiate an intensive 5 or 10 minute long artillery barrage on Seoul, killing some Americans and South Koreans near Yongsan Garrison, Dragon Mountain, the American military's green zone in the heart of the city. Then the North would simply stop. And after the shell fire halted, the proverbial question among American officers in a quandary would arise. What now, Lieutenant? Politically speaking, we would be trumped. The South Korean left, which has been made powerful by an intrusively large American troop presence and by decades of manipulation by the North, would blame the United States for the carnage in Seoul, pointing out that it had been provoked by the Americans' targeted strike against North Korea. The United Nations and the global media would subtly blame Washington for the crisis and call, not so subtly, for peace talks. With that, the KFR would get a new lease on life, with more aid forthcoming from the international community to keep it afloat. Which is why some of the military and civilian experts I spoke with argue for economic warfare against the North. Stop helping the regime with humanitarian aid, they say. The North Korean population has been on the brink of starvation for decades. The forests are denuded. People are eating tree bark. Stop prolonging the agony. Help the KFR collapse. Of course, one problem with this strategy is that it could end up making North Korea's direst military options more likely. As noted, regimes like this one, in the latter stages of collapse, are apt to behave irresponsibly, possibly resorting to WMD. Another problem is that we can't do much to squeeze the North Koreans economically. It's China, not the United States, that is really keeping the regime alive. The Chinese are already in the process of gaining operational control over anything in North Korea that has strategic, economic, and military value, mines, railways, and so on. Thus, any soft landing for the KFR would more likely be orchestrated by Beijing than by Washington, even though the Chinese might not mind saddling the Americans with the short-term military responsibility of stabilizing a collapsed North Korea. After reunification. If the peninsula could be stabilized after the fall of the KFR, this Greater Korea would have an instant, undisputed enemy, Japan. Any Korean politician would be able to stand up in parliament and get political mileage out of an anti-Japanese tirade. The Japanese know this, and it's helping fuel their remilitarization. The Japanese Navy, in particular, has been emphasizing the latest diesel submarines and Aegis destroyers. In July, there was a saber-rattling contest between Tokyo and Seoul over disputed islets that South Koreans call Tokdo and the Japanese Takashima, in what the Koreans refer to as the East Sea and the Japanese the Sea of Japan. Harsh words were exchanged after South Korea sent a survey ship to the area. The United States has a history of underestimating historical ethnic disputes. In the 1980s, it paid insufficient attention to ethnic tensions in Yugoslavia. More recently, it mistakenly downplayed Sunni-Shiite tensions in Iraq. It should not make the same mistake in Asia. Here it is useful to review Korean history. In the medieval era, the Koreans fought wars against Chinese dynasties like the Sui and the Tang. But later on, following the rise to power of Korea's own Joseon dynasty in 1392, Japan gradually caught up with China as Korea's principal adversary. There was a brutal Japanese violation of the peninsula at the end of the 16th century, culminating in an orgy of rape and murder, and a savage occupation at the beginning of the 20th, which ended only with the Soviet and American conquests. The Japanese effect on the peninsula has not been all negative. South Koreans may have trouble admitting it, but Japanese colonialism in the early 20th century nearly doubled the life expectancy of the average Korean. Reunification would provide at least one benefit to Japan. As Park Chung-hee, an analyst at the Asia Strategy Institute in Seoul, explained to me, a unified Greater Korea might serve to balance against an even more significant threat to Japan, a rising China. But this Greater Korea would still be a linchpin of China's 21st century Asian economic prosperity sphere, a more benign version of Imperial Japan's co-prosperity sphere of the 1940s. America could be pushed to the margins. Although Korean businessmen would resist economic domination by China, lingering anti-Americanism in South Korea might outweigh that resistance, especially once the generation that still remembers the sacrifices of American servicemen during the 1950s disappears entirely. America's large troop presence will have granted Korea a free society, just as a similar American presence helped to make Germany a free society. But younger generations of South Koreans may remember U.S. troops only negatively, and what is more indelibly inscribed in the Korean national memory is America's support for the Japanese occupation of Korea following the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 and 1905. This was in exchange for Imperial Japan's support of America's occupation of the Philippines a few years earlier. Greater Korea's troubled relationship with China may ultimately be determined by what America does, and specifically by the degree to which the United States can get Japan to recognize its war guilt. If Washington continues to maintain a military alliance with Tokyo without Japan's publicly coming to terms with its past, Greater Korea will move psychologically toward China. President Bush's recent love fest with Japanese Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi at Graceland may have played well in the United States, but it was seen as an insult in South Korea because of Koizumi's earlier visit to the Yasukuni Shrine, which honors the Japanese war dead, including war criminals. If the United States continues to treat Japan as a golden stepchild, then China and its implicit ally, Greater Korea, will have a tense relationship with Japan and its implicit allies, the United States and India. But because of its own manifold business interests in China, America could only balance against China very delicately. China versus America. With so many complex and subtle interests to weigh here, what should the American strategy be over the long term? South Korean Army Colonel Chung Kyung-yung, a professor at Seoul's National Defense University, says that after the KFR collapses and the North is stabilized, the wisest thing for the United States to do would be to keep 10,000 troops or so on the peninsula. Such a contingent, he told me, would serve as a statement that the United States is not abandoning Korea to a militarily resurgent Japan. The best way to stabilize Asia, Chung emphasizes, would be to prevent Greater Korea, which would be fragile in the period after the North's collapse, from becoming a source of contention between China and Japan. Peter Beck, the director of the International Crisis Group's Northeast Asia Project, agrees. Because the United States is the furthest away of all these powers, he told me, it should be perceived as the least dangerous, the one power without territorial ambitions. Unfortunately, South Korean politics might make it more difficult to keep American troops on the peninsula long term. Yes, it's true that of the few prominent statues of foreigners in the country, two are of Americans, General Douglas MacArthur and General James Van Fleet, the father of the South Korean Armed Forces. And it is also true that, because of late 19th century missionary activity, American-style Protestantism is practically the dominant religion in South Korea. If North Korea collapses, expect Christian evangelism to quickly replace the communist regime's Juche ethos of self-reliance. Pyongyang was once the Jerusalem of Asia for missionaries. And yet, despite all this, the South Koreans have largely convinced themselves that they need to be as worried about the Americans as they are about the Chinese, just as they have convinced themselves that they should be as afraid of the Japanese as they are of the North Koreans. The fact is that South Koreans may not want any American troops in their country. Already, the American air and ground troops who would defend the South if the KFR were to attack are facing increasing restrictions on their training because of South Korean political pressures. The A-10 squadron that would be flying non-stop sorties near the DMZ in the event of a war had to train in Thailand this past winter because of limitations Seoul placed on its flight patterns. This is all part of yet another frustration that U.S. troops in South Korea must endure, having to be on a war footing in order to defend a government that wants to be defended but publicly pretends otherwise. The truth is, many South Koreans have an interest in the perpetuation of the Kim family regime, or something like it, since the KFR's demise would usher in a period of economic sacrifice that nobody in South Korea is prepared for. A long-standing commitment by the American military has allowed the country to evolve into a materialistic society. Few South Koreans have any interest in the disruption the collapse of the KFR would produce. Meanwhile, China's infrastructure investments are already laying the groundwork for a Tibet-like buffer state in much of North Korea, to be ruled indirectly through Beijing's Korean cronies once the KFR unravels. This buffer state will be less oppressive than the morbid, crushing tyranny it will replace. So, from the point of view of the average South Korean, the Chinese look to be offering a better deal than the Americans, whose plan for a free and democratic unified peninsula would require South Korean taxpayers to pay much of the cost. The more that Washington thinks narrowly in terms of a democratic Korean peninsula, the more Beijing has the potential to lock the United States out of it. For there is a yawning distance between the Stalinist KFR tyranny and a stable Western-style democracy. In between these extremes lie several categories of mixed regimes and benign dictatorships, any of which might offer the North Koreans far more stability as a transition mechanism than anything the United States might be able to provide. No one should forget that South Korea's prosperity and state cohesion were achieved not under a purely democratic government, but under Park Chung-hee's benign dictatorship of the 1960s and 70s. Furthermore, North Koreans, who were never ruled by the British, have even less historical experience with democracy than Iraqis. Ultimately, victory on the Korean Peninsula will go to the side with the most indirect and nuanced strategy. The long-term success of America's basic policy on the peninsula hinges on the willingness of South Koreans to make a significant sacrifice at some point for the sake of freedom in the North. But sacrifice is not a word that voters in free and prosperous societies tend to like. If voters in Western-style democracies are good at anything, it's rationalizing their own selfishness, and it may turn out that the authoritarian Chinese understand the voters of South Korea's free and democratic society better than we do. If that's the case, there may never actually be a Greater Korea in the way that we imagine it. Rather, the North's demise will be carefully managed by Beijing in such a way that the country will go from being a rogue nation to a de facto satellite of the Middle Kingdom, but one with sufficient contact with the South that the Korean yearning for a measure of reunification will be satisfied. Keep in mind that Asia, largely because it is so economically dynamic, is politically and militarily volatile. Its alliance structures are not nearly as developed as those in Europe, which has NATO and the European Union. Conflicting nationalisms are expressed in Asia through more than just soccer games. Thus, the question of whether it's to be the American or the Chinese vision of North Korea's future that gets realized may hinge on political-military decisions made in the midst of an opaque and confusing crisis. North Korea and the Future of Asia. Before I left Seoul, I met with a local military legend. Retired General Paek Sun-yup, now 86 years old, was the 1st Infantry Division commander during the Korean War and worked hand-in-hand with General MacArthur. When we spoke, Paek insisted that crisis-driven political-military decisions here will ultimately determine the balance of power throughout Asia, the most important region for the world's economy. This peninsula is the pivot, he said. When I reflected on Peck's words later, it occurred to me that while the United States is in its 4th year of a war in Iraq, it has been on a war footing in Korea for 56 years now. More than 10 times as many Americans have been killed on the Korean Peninsula as in Mesopotamia. Most Americans hope and expect that we will withdraw from Iraq within a few years, yet we still have 32,000 troops in South Korea, more than half a century after the armistice. Korea provides a sense of America's daunting, imperial-like burdens. But South Korea also provides a lesson in what can be accomplished with patience and dogged persistence. The drive from the airport at Incheon to downtown Seoul goes through the heart of a former urban war zone. South Korea's capital was taken and retaken 4 times in some of the most intense fighting of the Korean War. Korean men and women who lived through that time will always be grateful for what retired U.S. Army Colonel Robert Killebrew has called American stick-to-itiveness, without which we would have little hope of remaining a great power. In the heart of Seoul lies Yongsan Garrison, a leafy, fortified Little America, guarded and surrounded by high walls. Inside these 630 acres, which closely resemble the Panama Canal Zone before the Americans gave it up, are 8,000 American military and diplomatic personnel in manicured suburban homes surrounded by neatly clipped hedges and backyard barbecue grills. I drove by a high school, baseball and football fields, a driving range, a hospital, a massive commissary, a bowling alley, and restaurants. U.S. Forces Korea and its attendant bureaucracies are located in red brick buildings that the Americans inherited in 1945 from the Japanese occupiers. Korea is so substantial a military commitment for us that it merits its own semi-autonomous subcommand of PACOM, just as Iraq, unofficially anyway, merits its own four-star subcommand of CENTCOM. The United States hopes to complete a troop drawdown in South Korea in 2008. Having moved into Yongsan Garrison when Korea's future seemed highly uncertain, American troops plan to give up this prime downtown real estate and relocate to Camp Humphreys in Pyeongtaek, 30 miles to the south. The number of ground troops will drop to 25,000 and will essentially comprise a skeleton of logistical support shops, which would be able to acquire muscles and tendons in the form of a large invasion force in the event of a war or a regime collapse that necessitated a military intervention. Patience and dogged persistence are heroic attributes. But while military units can be expected to be heroic, one should not expect a home front to be forever so. And while in the fullness of time, patience and dogged persistence can breed success, it is the kind of success that does not necessarily reward the victor, but rather the player best able to take advantage of the new situation. It is far too early to tell who ultimately will benefit from a stable and prosperous Mesopotamia, if one should ever emerge. But in the case of Korea, it looks like it will be the Chinese. War and its costs. 6. Rereading Vietnam. The Atlantic, August 2007. In 1943, at the age of 18, George Everett "Bud" Day of Sioux City, Iowa, enlisted in the Marines. He served in the Pacific during World War II and later became a fighter pilot. He flew the F-84F Thunderstreak during the Korean War and the F-100F Super Sabre in Vietnam. Bud Day, a legendary full-blooded jet jock, as one recent account dubbed him, would see service in all three wars as a sanctified whole. For him, the concept of the Long War was something he had built his life around in the middle decades of the 20th century. As an Air Force major, he was the first commander of the squadron of Fast Facts, forward air controllers, who loitered daily for hours over North Vietnamese airspace, seeking out targets for other fighter bombers. With the most dangerous air mission in the Vietnam War, Day and the other Fast Facts were known as Misty Warriors. Misty was the radio call sign that Day himself had chosen for the squadron, inspired by his favorite Johnny Mathis song. The Misties were an aggressive bunch of bastards who pressed the fight. They got down in the weeds and trolled for trouble, writes Robert Corum in a recently published book about Bud Day, American Patriot. On August 26, 1967, Bud Day's luck ran out. He was shot down over North Vietnam. The military code of conduct required that escape take priority over personal fears and concerns, Day writes in his own memoir, Duty, Honor, Country, published in 1989 by American Hero Press, Fort Walton Beach, Florida. Not ranked on Amazon, it is among the most amazing personal stories of any war. His eardrums ruptured, his face crusted with blood from beatings, one arm broken, and both knees badly injured from the ejection, Bud Day was hung by the feet like a side of butchered beef for many hours by his captors after he refused to answer their questions. A week into his captivity, he escaped. He then hiked 12 days alone in the jungle back to South Vietnam, eating frogs, nauseous from pain, only to be recaptured. With all of his limbs now broken or shot up, he spent the next 6 years in captivity, undergoing mock executions, hung again repeatedly by his feet, often not permitted to urinate, beaten senseless in scenes out of the Mongol hordes with whips that made his testicles like charred meat. When prison guards burst in on him and other POWs during a clandestine Christian service, Day stared into their muzzles and sang the Star-Spangled Banner. A recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor, Day took the greatest pride in never revealing information to his captors about the Misty program. If I were to divulge our secrets and tactics, it was highly likely that many of my fine young loyal pilots would die as a result. I met Bud Day in September 2005 at the Jacksonville Naval Air Station, where Navy flyers had lined up to buy his book, for which he had to take payments in cash. I thought it demeaning that he had to sell his book this way. It says something about the blind spots of a Manhattan-based publishing industry that Day had to go to what is essentially a vanity press. The publication of Coram's book is, therefore, a welcome event. The relative obscurity of Day's autobiography and other books like it about Vietnam constitute a lesser-known aspect of our civilian-military divide. The books to which I refer should be part of our recollection of Vietnam, but they generally aren't. They aren't so much stories that soldiers tell civilians as those that soldiers tell each other. Of course, there are exceptions, most famously James Webb's Fields of Fire, 1978, a book that overlaps with this category and, in fact, did become a bestseller. But there is a range of books of lesser literary merit, yet of equal historical worth, that either have small readerships or readerships consisting overwhelmingly of military personnel, active duty and retired. The authors of these lesser-known books include Marines and Green Berets, Army Special Forces, who were involved in counterinsurgency operations. Their writing reveals a second divide, that between professional warriors and conventional citizen soldiers, which is but another facet of the warrior's alienation from the civilian world. To explore this second divide, I must also bring into the discussion a French writer and a British soldier, whose legacies include not only Indochina, but Algeria and pre-World War II Palestine, scenes too of messy, irregular warfare. Thus, my notion of another Vietnam library goes beyond the subject at hand. Reading habits are influenced by the people you meet. If I hadn't had the opportunity to embed with professional warriors, I would never have heard of some of these books. For example, I learned a great deal about Bud Day and Duty Honor Country from Air Force Captain Jeremiah Parvin of Rocky Mount, North Carolina, a young A-10 Warthog pilot with a Misty patch on his arm. The A-10 is essentially a flying Gatling gun. Its pilots hover low to the ground and loiter over the battlefield at great risk. Even as they disdain the rest of the Air Force, Marines and Green Berets consider A-10 pilots true warriors. A-10 pilots feel the same bond toward combat infantry. It is a trait of professional warriors that they feel closer to those in other armed services who take similar risks than toward men and women in their own service who don't. Being in the military is not enough for these men. To earn their respect, you had to have joined in order to fight, not to better your career or your station in life. Captain Parvin was serving in South Korea when I met him. He hoped soon to be deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan. He told me all about the Misty facts in Vietnam. He showed me a coin that he always carried in his pocket, commemorating the Misties, with Bud Day's name inscribed on it. It was a tradition in his squadron that the youngest and oldest members always carried the coin on their person. Whenever there is a reunion of Misty warriors from Vietnam, held usually in the Florida Panhandle, where Day now lives, the pilots of Parvin's A-10 squadron, two generations removed, send a representative. Bud Day's memoir is riveting, but it is also a raw manuscript in need of an editor. His tirades against the likes of Lyndon Johnson and the dingbat traitor Jane Fonda get tiresome. To be sure, Day's address to the Navy flyers the morning I met him was laced with colorful profanities, but it was his very rage and aggression against communism, against the Democratic Party of the era, against those whom he considered weak soldiers in America's own ranks, against many things, that allowed him to survive more than half a decade of sustained torture. Among the persons he dedicates his book to is President Richard M. Nixon, for ordering Linebacker 1 and Linebacker 2, the 1972 bombings of North Vietnam, the latter known as the Christmas bombings, and for giving the go-ahead to the Santee Raiders, the Green Berets out of Fort Bragg, North Carolina, who in November 1970 stormed the Santee prison west of Hanoi, where POWs were believed to have been held. Because the prisoners had been moved from Santee nearly 4 months earlier, the raid was harshly criticized by major newspapers and some Democratic senators, notably William Fulbright, who questioned the real purpose of the mission beyond freeing the prisoners. A New York Times editorial said the raid was likely to widen the home front credibility gap. Yet as Day recounts, the raid, along with the bombing campaigns that followed, constituted enormous morale boosts for the prisoners and led to improved treatment for them. Today among Green Berets, the Santee Raiders are looked upon as though mythical heroes from a bygone age. What Bud Day and other POWs specifically admired about Nixon was his willingness to strike back in a way that Johnson hadn't. Johnson's bombing halt in 1968 was seen as a betrayal by POWs and caused disappointment and anger even throughout the U.S. military. Remember that these POWs were often combat pilots, professional warriors and volunteers, that is, not citizen soldiers who were drafted. Professional warriors are not fatalists. In their minds, there is no such thing as defeat so long as they are still fighting, even from prison. That belief is why true soldiers have an affinity for seemingly lost causes. In December 1967, a prisoner was dumped in Day's cell on the outskirts of Hanoi, known as the Plantation. This prisoner's legs were atrophied, and he weighed under 100 pounds. Day helped scrub his face and nurse him back from the brink of death. The fellow American was Navy Lieutenant Commander John Sidney McCain III of the Panama Canal Zone. As his health improved, McCain's rants against his captors were sometimes as ferocious as Day's. The North Vietnamese tried and failed, through torture, to get McCain to accept a release for their own propaganda purposes. The lieutenant commander was the son of Admiral John McCain Jr., the commander of all American forces in the Pacific. "Character," writes the younger McCain, quoting the 19th century evangelist Dwight Moody, "is what you are in the dark, when nobody's looking, and you silently make decisions about how you will act the next day." In early 1973, during a visit to Hanoi, North Vietnamese officials told Secretary of State Henry Kissinger that they would be willing to free McCain into his custody. Kissinger refused, aware that there were prisoners held longer than McCain ahead of him in the line for release. McCain suffered a while longer in confinement, then, once freed, thanked Kissinger for preserving my honor. The two have been good friends since. McCain blurbs with gusto Bud Day's memoir. The senator writes, "I recommend this book to anyone who wants to understand the dimensions of human greatness." The term professional warrior is explicitly used by Navy Vice Admiral James Bond Stockdale of Abingdon, Illinois, to describe himself in A Vietnam Experience, 10 Years of Reflection, Hoover Institution Press, 1984. I learned in depth about Vice Admiral Stockdale's writings in this and a second book, Thoughts of a Philosophical Fighter Pilot, Hoover, 1995, from midshipmen at the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, where I teach. One mid told me that the moral lessons Stockdale provides helped inspire him to go to the academy. Stockdale himself is a symbol of a civilian-military divide. The very way you recall him upon hearing his name shows on what side of the divide you fall. Most civilians remember Stockdale as H. Ross Perot's seemingly dazed vice presidential candidate, who in the 1992 debate with Al Gore and Dan Quayle asked aloud, "Who am I? Why am I here?" and later requested that a question be repeated since he had not turned on his hearing aid. In fact, Stockdale, a lifelong student of philosophy, had meant his questions to be rhetorical, a restatement of the most ancient and essential of questions. Because of television's ability to ruin people's lives by catching them in an embarrassing moment in time, too few are aware that Stockdale's vice presidential bid was insignificant compared with almost everything else he did. Those on the other side of the divide remember him as among the most selfless and self-reflecting heroes the armed services have ever produced. In September 1965, then Navy Commander Stockdale, the equivalent of a lieutenant colonel, was forced to eject from his A-4 Sky Raider over North Vietnam. He spent the next 7 years in prison, undergoing the usual barbaric treatment that the North Vietnamese communists meted out to Americans who did not provide information. Told that he was going to be shown to foreign journalists, Stockdale, a Medal of Honor winner, slashed his scalp with a razor and beat himself in the face with a wooden stool to prevent being used for propaganda purposes. When George McGovern said he would go to Hanoi on his knees, we prisoners were humiliated, Stockdale writes. We did not go anywhere on our knees, least of all home. Most of us would be there now rather than knuckle under, he writes in 1984. Unlike in World War II, when the Japanese and Germans considered POWs to be liabilities and a drain on resources, the North Vietnamese considered captured American pilots as prime political assets. For POWs, not allowing themselves to be used as such meant being able to withstand years of torture. Rather than victims, men like Day, McCain, and Stockdale, once incarcerated, continued to see themselves as warriors, fighting on the most difficult of fronts. Moral philosophy, in particular the Stoics, helped Stockdale survive. As he puts it after he ejected from his plane, I left my world of technology and entered the world of Epictetus. Epictetus was a Greek-born philosopher in first-century Rome, whose Stoic beliefs arose from his brutal treatment as a slave. Stockdale explains, Stoics belittle physical harm, but this is not braggadocio. They are speaking of it in comparison to the devastating agony of shame they fancied good men generating when they knew in their hearts that they had failed to do their duty. When Stockdale writes about Epictetus, Socrates, Homer, Cervantes, Calvin, and other writers and philosophers, their work achieves a soaring reality because he relates them to his own extraordinary experiences as a prisoner in one of the 20th century's most barbaric penal programs. Stockdale reminds us about something that much scholarship, with its obsession for textual subtleties, obscures. The real purpose of reading the classics is to develop courage and leadership. Stockdale explains, drawing on Napoleon, Clausewitz, and other military strategists, that the word moral bears an unmistakably manly, heroic connotation. Virtue, or virtù in Machiavelli's Italian, derives ultimately from vir, Latin for man. He says that while we think of immorality in terms of categories like sexual abandon and fiscal irresponsibility, such vices, as serious as they may seem to civilians, are not in the same category as failure of nerve, his italics, in war. For a professional warrior, doing your duty is not to be confused with following orders. The latter implies routine and mechanistic repetition, the former, an act of potentially painful and devastating consequences, in which serving a larger good may mean something worse than death even. The implications of doing your duty are spelled out further in Bury Us Upside Down, The Misty Pilots and the Secret Battle for the Ho Chi Minh Trail, Ballantine, 2006, by Rick Newman, a journalist at U.S. News and World Report, and Don Shepard, a former Mistie. They write that in November 1967, in order to rescue Captain Lance Saigon of Milwaukee, a smokescreen of cluster bombs was dropped near North Vietnamese anti-aircraft guns so that the guns could be taken out by low-flying F-4 Phantoms, throwing enemy air defenses into enough chaos to allow a helicopter to pick up the downed pilot. The operation failed. Captain Saigon, injured worse than Bud Day during ejection, evaded the North Vietnamese for 6 weeks. After he was captured, he escaped again, then was recaptured, and died of torture and pneumonia. He was awarded the Medal of Honor posthumously. This occurred while the pilots were operating under extremely restrictive ROEs, rules of engagement. Stockdale describes bombing runs over Hanoi in which each plane had to follow the other in exactly the same path, with almost no unscheduled maneuvering permitted, significantly increasing the chance of a plane being shot down, in order to reduce the chances of errant bombs hitting civilians. He and other pilots rage over how restrictive rather than wanton were the so-called Christmas bombings, which incidentally were called off on Christmas Day. Few other air campaigns in history were fought under such limited ROEs and yet achieved such an immediate and desired political impact, the return of the North Vietnamese to the negotiating table, the release of the POWs, and the end of America's military involvement in the war. The equivalent would have been if the pinprick bombings ordered by President Bill Clinton on Iraq in 1998 had led to a regime change in Baghdad, or a change of heart by Saddam Hussein that opened the country unambiguously to United Nations weapons inspections. Bury Us Upside Down documents the lives of men who, like Bud Day, served in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, a fact that inspires envy among professional warriors I know. If I had the choice, I would have been born before the Great Depression, Army Special Forces Master Sergeant Mark Lopez of Yuba City, California, told me recently. That way I could have enlisted at 18 and fought in World War II and Korea, and still be young enough to have seen action in Vietnam. Yet my favorite story in Bury Us Upside Down is about a different sort of serviceman, Air Force flight surgeon Dean Eckenberg of San Francisco, a former hippie who helped start a free clinic in Haight-Ashbury, did drugs, went to the Great Rock concerts, and then volunteered for service in Vietnam, more or less out of sheer adventure. He ended up with the Misties, billeted among men whom Bud Day had trained. If anyone lived the American experience of the 1960s in its totality, it was Eckenberg. One day in 1968, his medical unit was near Phu Cát, just as it was attacked by Viet Cong. The dispensary quickly filled with blood and body parts, write the authors. Parents and family members staggered around in a daze, desperate for their children to be saved. Eckenberg worked almost the entire night with a pretty American nurse. Near dawn, emotionally overwrought, the two lay down to rest near the end of the runway on the American base and made love in the grass while artillery boomed in the distance. Eckenberg struggled to understand how anybody could be so savage as to murder children. The authors continue. The young doctor had been ambivalent about the war when he first showed up in Vietnam, but he could no longer humor the anti-war protesters he knew. Yes, combat was inhumane, and atrocities happened on both sides, especially during the heat of battle. But he didn't see the communists as freedom fighters or revolutionaries like the crowd back in San Francisco. To him, the communists were savages who terrorized civilians. It was another young A-10 pilot, Air Force Captain Brandon Kelly of Cairo, Georgia, a forward air controller on the ground in Iraq, one of the most dangerous jobs there, who told me about Bury Us Upside Down, which was not reviewed prominently. Captain Kelly told me that to fully understand what motivated people like him, I had to read this book. Protests against the war spawned ideologies. Everything about Vietnam had to be rejected. The result was a shunning of this excellent book. Fashionable journals declined to review it, writes former Defense Secretary James Schlesinger in the preface to a reissue of Bing West's The Village, 1972. While the battle in Mark Bowdoin's Black Hawk Down, 1999, lasted a day, and the one in Harold Moore and Joe Galloway's We Were Soldiers Once and Young, 1992, lasted 3 days, The Village is about a Marine squad that fought in the same place for 495 days. Half of them died, 7 out of 15. All of them had volunteered to go to The Village, a job they knew would likely get them killed. Their reason? As the commanding sergeant tells the author, "You have a sense of independence down here. There's no paperwork. You're always in contact with the Viet Cong. You know you have a job to do. You go out at night, and you do it." And so, these Marines left their base camp, with its canvas cots, solid bunkers, ice cream, and endless guard rosters, and went to live with some Vietnamese. In West's story, there is no sense of defeat and doom and perversion as in classic Hollywood movies about Vietnam, no beautiful, ingeniously constructed and introspective narration about soldiers and their vulnerabilities beset with moral complexities, as in a work like Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, 1990, a favorite of high school and college literature courses. West has not written a better book than O'Brien, himself a twice-wounded veteran of the war, but he has written a very different, equally worthy kind that, outside of the members of the military who have regularly recommended it to me over the years, is still relatively little known. The Village is a story of interminable, deadly, monotonous life-and-death nighttime patrols, dryly and technically narrated, as though extracted from the pages of 100 strung-together after-action briefs. To wit, he had fired 20 bullets in one excited burst, yet missed because he had used a magazine which contained no tracers. Unable to see his fire, he had failed to lead properly when the scout ducked around the corner of the house. The book is as absent of style as it is of negativity. Like any good field manual, it has no time for that. As I said, warriors are not fatalists. The Village deals with what works in a counterinsurgency struggle and what doesn't. It is a story meant for war colleges that the public, too, desperately needs to know. For the redeeming side of the Vietnam War it reflects was not an aberration. The Marines of Bing West's story constituted a CAP, Combined Action Platoon, which moved into Binh Nha in early 1966, a village terrorized by the Viet Cong, and over 18 bloody months pacified it, taking unabashed pride in their work. Many of the Marines, West writes, let months go by without writing a letter or reading a newspaper. The radius of their world was 2 miles. The following passage helps explain why many Vietnam veterans I meet in the course of my reporting have not altogether negative memories of that war. The Americans liked the village. They liked the freedom to drink beer and wear oddball clothes and joke with girls. They liked having the respect of tough PFs, Popular Forces Government Militia, who could not bring themselves to challenge the Viet Cong alone. They were pleased that the villagers were impressed because they hunted the Viet Cong as the Viet Cong had for years hunted the PFs. The Americans did not know what the villagers said of them, but they observed that the children, who did hear their parents, did not run or avoid them. The Marines had accepted too many invitations to too many meals in too many homes to believe they were not liked by many and tolerated by most. For perhaps the only time in the lives of those Americans, 7 of whom had not graduated from high school, they were providing, at the obvious risk of death, a service of protection. This had won them open admiration within the Vietnamese village society in which they were working, and where ultimately most of them would die. West, a former Marine in Vietnam who made periodic visits to the platoon, ends his story thus. In July of 1967, Binh Nha was no longer the scene of nightly battles. The enemy had accepted the persistence of the unit, the CAP, whereas his own determination to defend Binh Nha had waned. That victory was won by Marines who never accepted that the village was lost, even when the platoon was surrounded by 300 Viet Cong. The Marines had done too many nighttime stakeouts, lying immovable for too many hours in filthy puddles, with rain pouring down as though out of a shower faucet, to simply retreat. The Village demonstrates that the military has memories that the public doesn't. To many who grew up in the 1960s, Vietnam was a cause, but to those who fought it, Vietnam was foremost a war in all its gray shades, with its tactical successes and tactical failures, with its Marine caps and Green Beret infiltrations that worked, and its big army ones that didn't, with its army generals who succeeded like Creighton Abrams, and its army generals who failed like William Westmoreland, with its moments of glory like Hue, and its moments of disgrace like My Lai, and, above all, with its heroes, like the Son Tay Raiders and the Misty Forward Air Controllers. In 2002, Bing West returned to Binh Nha. In a new epilogue, he writes, "Once a year, the villagers gather to pray for good crops and no floods by a cement wall bearing a Vietnamese inscription to the Marines who built the well and the shrine in 1967. The village remembers." Across the Fence, The Secret War in Vietnam, 2003, by John Stryker Meyer, is even more compact, technical, and intense than The Village. Like Bud Day's Duty Honor Country, it was published by a tiny press, in this case Real War Stories Incorporated, and went unreviewed. It was recommended to me by a Green Beret Sergeant Major from rural Pennsylvania, Jack Hagen, whose friend had fought in the unit Meyer writes about. The book constitutes an intimate memory in its own right, another example of stories that warriors tell themselves. The cheap and slightly out-of-focus jacket design suggests a term paper quality manuscript that will be a chore to read. Yet, as combat writing goes, Across the Fence is pure grain alcohol. It is not replete with rich, unforgettable descriptions, but rather a work of dry realism that makes no attempt at profundity and is thus unburdened by doubt, the warrior's great strength. There is bitching about physical discomfort, but no complaints about the purpose of the war. So little emotion is there that the author allows himself only a brief and passing broadside against Johnson's ceasefire and what he considers the antagonism of the media. John Stryker Meyer and the men in his unit, as he writes, were triple volunteers. They had volunteered for Army Parachute Jump School at Fort Benning, Georgia, then for Army Special Forces training at Fort Bragg, and finally to serve in the command and control element of MACV SOG, Military Assistance Command Vietnam Studies and Observation Group. This was a joint unit engaged in classified, unconventional warfare in Laos and Cambodia, places known respectively as the Prairie Fire and Daniel Boone AOs, areas of operations, or just plain Indian country, in Meyer's own words. The book's title is military lingo for across the border from Vietnam, where the North Vietnamese Army, as the author writes, had moved soldiers, supplies, rockets, guns, and propagandists south into the eastern provinces of these so-called neutral countries, whose territories were an integral part of the Ho Chi Minh Trail complex. Across the Fence was published only in 2003. Meyer had signed a government document in 1968 pledging never to write or talk publicly about SOG for 20 years. After that, he explains, anti-Vietnam sentiment made it difficult to find a publisher who would buy the concept of a Vietnam book that dealt with real people striving against unbelievable odds in a politically handicapped war. Encouraged by his writing teachers at Trenton State College, Meyer eventually produced a battlefield diary of daily forays into Laos and Cambodia in 1968 and 1969. Arriving at a SOG base in Vietnam, the author was shown into a barracks, where on one double bunk, sweaty and naked, was a couple heavily involved in the rapture of the moment. Nearby, he found an SF, Special Forces trooper, showering, while a naked Vietnamese woman squatted in the water, washing herself. Seeing that he was an FNG, fucking new guy, a sergeant explained to him that the prostitutes were given weekly health checkups and what the prices were. These were men away from home for many months. A significant percentage of them were soon to die. Meyer himself was momentarily to enter an existence where life was a matter of inches. Three rounds slammed into the 10s recon team leader's head, blowing off the right side of his face. Nothing in the months of pulling garbage detail could prepare ST, Spike Team Alabama, for the grisly horror unfolding at that moment. The 1-1, assistant